about what this story is. He is a contributor to the New York Times and also a staff reporter for the News on Sunday. And yesterday's New York Times went like this: Islamabad, Pakistan, with flooding affecting one-fifth of Pakistan and worsening by the day. UN officials said yesterday a shortage of aid funds was leaving some 6 million people, the majority of them children and infants, at risk of potentially lethal diseases by dirty water. Clean water, according to a UN spokesman, is urgently needed right now. The UN has appealed for international donations of $460 million, but only one-third of that money has been provided. Clean water has been distributed to just 1 million people. There was the first wave of deaths caused by the floods themselves, but this spokesperson says if we don't act soon enough, there will be a second wave of deaths caused by a combination of lack of clean water, food shortages, waterborne and vector-borne diseases. The picture, he said, is a gruesome one. Couple all of that with a disaster that threatens to stabilize the political regime of the country, and reports that Islamic extremist groups have been giving more aid than the government has. $75 million has come from America. But the disaster is huge, a security crisis, obviously a huge humanitarian crisis with 20 million people affected. 19 days after the monsoon rains, the floods came in waves. There is more rain coming now, and we will be talking about all of this. We'll have two guests during the course of this hour. We'll be starting with Waqar Jilani, who's a staff reporter for the News on Sunday and a contributor to the New York Times. And a little bit later, Danish Mustafa will join us, a professor of geography at King's College in London, who's done a great deal of work about the river and studied the history of Pakistan's river management. So we'll be looking at flooding in previous times. This, of course, has been called a flood of biblical proportions. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. One moment. Let me get the book, which is on the other side of the studio, for the second hour of the program. This is really an interesting book, and it's on many, many levels. The author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error, and Bill McKibben says this about the book: it's wise and clever, full of fun and surprise about a topic so central to our lives, we almost never even think about it. But for that reason, this volume could also be enormously useful. There are very few problems we face as individuals or as a society that couldn't be helpfully addressed if we were willing to at least entertain the idea that we may not be entirely right. So that's coming up, hour number two. We have our connection now to Lahore, Pakistan. Waqar Jilani is our guest. The first half hour of the program has been writing extensively, if you've been looking at the New York Times for most of this month, about these horrendous floods. Waqar Jilani, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell me, describe for me, please, where you are right now.
Right now, I'm in Lahore, and I'm again moving to that flood-rich zone tomorrow morning.
And please describe the how enormous this devastation is. It's hard for us to imagine being comfortable here in Wisconsin. 20 million people at risk here. Who knows how many people have died? And I understand there is more rain coming.
Yeah, there are more than 20 million people actually, which are directly or some indirectly affected by these devastating floods in Pakistan. And the scale of these floods is so enormous that in my own career and even in my life, I haven't seen like such a water in my life. That the whole villages, whole cities and towns are fully inundated, leaving the millions of people, forcing them to leave their houses and to leave their places and coming on the roads, waiting for the shelters and food and relief by the government. And their forecasts are more. Actually, in Pakistan, this is rainy season, actually. And the flood, which was caused by the first series of these rains, and now there's like consistently different, consequent series of rains, in different time to time. Even today, there is forecast for heavy rainfall in different areas of Pakistan.
So people are leaving their homes and they're just existing alongside roads? They're going as far away from the water as they can get? And then what do they do?
Sorry?
What do they do once they leave their homes? They have no place to go.
Yeah, they have no place to go. This is unfortunate, and the most surprising and astonishing part of this flood tragedy in Pakistan, which is one of the, I think, biggest human tragedy in the history of Pakistan, that people were not expecting this kind of big flood, high flood, and they were stuck to their homes. And when they knew about the warnings by the government, and when they knew that water is coming very speedily, then they started leaving their places. And that's why most of the people are still stuck in their own hometowns in high water, because they were not expecting this kind of flood. So now after leaving their place, they have to leave their houses hurriedly. They have to put their luggage, baggages, and all valuable things at their homes, whatever they could have taken with them, they could have taken them with them. They have taken with them, and they are on the roads or in the government camps or in the non-government organizations camps, and they are waiting for food and shelter. And obviously, they will be waiting for many weeks. Then water is down, and then they can go back to their homes and see what is the situation. I personally know many families. When I was in Muzaffargarh last week, one of the most hit areas in water, and many laborer class people, like they were coming with their children, with their sons and daughters and wives, women, and some of the baggage which they were carrying on their heads. And they were coming from deep waters. And when I asked him, what will they do now? And they said they will be just putting a camp on the main road, which is safe. And then they will be waiting for the water is down, and then they will be going back.
Oh, so sad. And you wrote extensively yesterday about disease, about diarrhea, and about cholera. How extensive is the disease?
Yeah, this is also one of the biggest post-flood effects in Pakistan, which usually we see when there is low flood, that enormously it is spreading in NWFP, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, Punjab province, and now when water has moved to Sindh province and Balochistan. So all four provinces, and mostly the rural areas, districts are hit by floods, and according to doctors, this disease, waterborne disease, is mainly cholera, mainly gastroenteritis, and malaria. All these things are spreading very fastly. And unluckily, these things are being spread in children. Mostly children are the most affected party in this diseases thing. In Rajanpur area in South Punjab of Pakistan, which is one of the most hit areas, more than 1500 children are affected within 10 days with gastroenteritis and with malaria things. So Pakistan, Pakistani government and doctors say they need maximum medicines, and they are trying to vaccinate maximum people. But they believe that this will happen because Pakistan's underground water is not well in that area. And secondly, this water is dirty water. So both waters are causing all these skin diseases and waterborne diseases.
We've seen reports on television here in the United States of so many children who are dying, actually, and they can't get antibiotics for the illnesses that they have. What's the problem with aid distribution? Are you not getting enough of it there, or is it hard for the drugs to get to hospitals? What's the holdup?
The problem with aid distribution, there are reports of attacks on the food convoys, attacks on the relief camps, because people are hungry and they want food. The tragedy is that this tragedy is so enormous, and suddenly 20 million people of Pakistan are on the roads, are on different camps, and they have no electricity, they have no food thing, they have no valuables with them, even they don't have money, many of them with them. And the government has not accessibility to all areas which are inundated. Mostly, there are still many pockets in southern Punjab, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and in Sindh and Balochistan, where water is very high, and even rescue teams, police, armies cannot go. And people which are put themselves safe on the top roofs of their houses, they are waiting for the food and all these things. So these are the tragedies, and these are the bad incidents which are being seen and which will be more drastically seen, I believe, when the water will be a little bit down, and you will see the causes and consequences of all these crises.
In one of your reports this week, you talked with a UN spokesperson who said the need for international donations is $460 million, but only one-third of that money has been provided.
Yeah, there are reports that even but UN Secretary General also visited the flood-hit areas a couple of days back, and he then appealed the world community that they should put more help and more donations for helping all these people, because this loss is so huge, and government even still is unable actually to access the maximum loss. And that's why the other thing which is being raised, unfortunately, all this lesser funding is the credibility of the spending of the funding, keeping the past of the country in view, because many people think and many countries think and many nations think that there was huge money given in earthquake in 2005 when thousands of people were affected, but that money was not spent in a proper way. So there are two questions. One, that money is like world is not paying attention to this crisis. Maybe they don't know the enormity of this crisis. And secondly, there is question of credibility, unluckily. So the government is trying to improve that credibility, and UN Secretary General, and yesterday we heard that Senator John Kerry is coming to visit those areas, and maybe they would be thinking to, I think, divert Kerry Lugar amount to the flood-hit areas rehabilitation. So these are the answers to the questions related to donations and funds and aid.
And is there legitimacy to these concerns about where the money is going? Is the current Pakistani government at all competent in dealing with this, to the extent that anybody can, in dealing with the enormity of this crisis and getting aid to people?
Yeah, this is again another tragedy with our country, that many people think that this government is not actually capable to manage the whole big affair of this flood and all these things. And because there are issues of governance, there are issues of transparency, and there are issues of capacity building and mechanism. And I will give you one example in this big tragedy, that when actually water started flooding in the province of Punjab, in southern Punjab, and it was like due, and the government knew that the flood will be coming to Sindh, towards Arabian Sea, and then moving towards the province of Balochistan. But unluckily, there were no big preparations made to deal with those waters, no embankment, no barrages where the improvement or repair was needed was done. And even the politicians are coming in to save their lands and all these things, and they are diverting water towards rural areas, towards villages. So these are the tragedies with Pakistan. But I think despite all these things, which I have observed personally, that people in Sindh, people in Punjab, they are waking up. And they are questioning the credibility of the government. They are questioning the eligibility of the elected representatives whom have gotten vote from these people. And now they are asking that where are those people who got vote from us? Now they should come here to help us. So the question is a little bit complex, that there is the issue of credibility, but I think that the world pressure and then the public pressure ultimately will force the government to show the result. Otherwise, the consequences of these mishaps will be seen in coming couple of years, because there will be big change in social and political landscape, which many intellectuals and many literate people feel now.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what happens with these floods. We've had floods in the United States, nowhere near what you're experiencing, but the water eventually recedes after a few days. What's happening with these floods? They're called of biblical proportions. Does the water not recede in any way?
Yeah, this is another interesting question. Actually, this is one of the heaviest floods after 1926. In the region, actually. And the scale of the water flow is enormously high and unprecedented. That's why, and actually water comes from that Afghanistan mountains and other mountains, Gilgit mountains, and then it comes to Punjab and then Sindh and Balochistan and then it falls in Arabian Sea. So the tragedy is that even the first wave of this highest flood has not started dropping in the sea yet, and another wave of mountains because of the rains, because of the hill torrents, has started pouring in. So that's why. The other thing is the leakages of many barrages and many embankments. The leakages of and the breaches in canals, breaches in barrages and breaches in many embankments had caused high overflow of water and even seepage of water. That has caused inundating in those areas. Even people were not expecting that water would come any time in the history. So now the areas where power plants were situated, where the oil refinery units were placed, all these are inundated because of the leakages of the barrages. So unless the water flow is down up to 400,000 cubic, which is the normal level of the water in the river Indus, unless then this water will be continue to flow, overflow, and then come into all these rural areas. And the expectations are that this flow will take another month, actually. By the middle of September, the river flow will be normal, and then this water will be down, and people in the most areas then would be able to go back after a month.
We're welcoming phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, joining us by phone today from Lahore, Pakistan, is Waqar Jilani. He is a contributor to the New York Times, has been writing extensively this month about the horrendous floods in Pakistan, the many aspects that we need to consider when it comes to these floods. First and foremost, of course, the humanitarian crisis. He's a staff reporter for the news on Sunday. He's with us for a few more minutes, so feel free to call in if you would like, if you have questions about this. He is on the scene. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. You wrote in yesterday's piece in the New York Times, the devastation has raised fears of further instability in Pakistan. Can you elaborate on that, please, Waqar?
Yeah, this question of instability is actually regarding this thing, which these are the developing things. If you see the other TV channels and read newspapers, that people are hungry, and there are fears of actually attacks on the convoys of the relief camps. And these things actually are causing instability, because this will ultimately cause, sorry for this interruption, this will cause instability at the social and political level. Because to deal with more than 20 million people will be a difficult task by the government. And if people are dissatisfied by the service of the government, by the service of the kind of relief they are getting, then it will be hard to meet these challenges, actually. So political instability is the question, because there were criticism that President Asif Ali Zardari was outside country when there were huge floods occurring in the first week and people were being displaced at that moment. And secondly, political parties are not still paying that attention to this issue, and people are doing the work on the self-help basis. So these are the questions which are actually causing the impressions of instability on the political ground.
Mm-hmm. And the long-term effects of this, the monsoons or the rains, I know, have been important for agriculture. I would imagine as a result of this, a lot of the fields have been totally destroyed, haven't they?
Yeah, surely. There are more than, only in Punjab, more than 2 million acres crop area have been devastated, and more than 3 million acres agriculture land and other areas of land have been devastated. Similarly, the amount of this land is equal in Sindh and now in Balochistan. Though agriculture is not that big in Balochistan, but it is very big in Sindh and in Punjab. And it will be causing, threats of actually food crisis and famine and all these things in future. Price hikes will be free. There will be no food. There will be shortage of grains and all these things. Even most of the tons and tons of wheat, which was available in the stores and which was being stored on the ground, it has been rotten because of the water, unfortunately.
Hmm. Let's go to a phone call. And Bob from Boscobel, hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
The question I had was, past disasters in Sri Lanka, we contributed to relief by working through organizations like World Vision, which are faith-based, Is there any possibility that the government of Pakistan would consider allowing those organizations to have some role in relief?
Yeah, it is not. Like, there are many banned organizations, and there are many extremist organizations which are working in these areas. But actually, people need help at that time. And when there will be no state infrastructure, they will be filling this gap. And people accept their help happily because they work at the grassroots level. And government at many points has indicated that there is no harm that if they help people in these critical crises, actually. But unfortunately, many people think they should understand the ultimate consequences of all these helps. Though Islamically and religiously, it is true that everybody should help, even at human level, each other. But ultimately, these are the seeds which they are growing in these rural and backward areas, where the mostly classes are poor, laborer, and uneducated.
And those people can be reached. Can airlifts be affected? I'm just trying to think of some way to save people. What can be done?
What can be done? This is like government should replace them, actually. Government should not give the opportunity to work these organizations in that way that they should win the sympathies. Rather than government should create its own cadres. It should actually fully activate its infrastructure and its all people in the district level administrations, that they should actually mostly help people rather than giving opportunity to these religious extremists, because then ultimately they will be gaining sympathy. But what can be done is like very important question, that at the moment I and many other people feel that nothing can be done because government is not operational fully in these areas, maybe because of inaccessibility or maybe because of lack of motivation.
This must be a very hard story for you to cover.
Yeah, sometimes it is hard. Like sometimes, but in flood areas, like we have been covering, and we gave a couple of stories in different newspapers. In last week, I covered in my newspaper about this story. But when these are the positive things which we mentioned, that they are doing relief work in these areas, this feels appealing to them, actually. And they think that by running these stories at local level, when people are not educated, they are actually winning sympathies even through press. But this is actually the issue of the policy matters. So at policy matters, government is not caring about this issue. And at local level, people are not aware of the actually consequences of these issues. So that's why they damn care. So to cover these issues is very easy here, because they think they are getting publicity. And people which are getting benefits, they believe that, like, they are helping us. And government thinks that they are paying their own duty, and that's all.
Oh, my. Thank you so much for keeping us informed here.
Thank you very much. I want to say one more thing.
Yes, please.
I appreciate the concerns and concerns of the people and the Wisconsin here, that they are worried and they want to know about this flood situation. And I hope that there should be issues by the public at America and Pakistani government level to raise the capacity building and to focus that all aid is properly used and reached to the deserving people.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest, the first half hour, Waqar Jalani. He is in Lahore, Pakistan right now. He's a contributor to the New York Times, had been writing about this in gripping articles the past month, or 19 days at least, and he is also a staff reporter for the news on Sunday. We'll continue our conversation, and our next guest is a professor of geography at King's College in London, Professor Danish Mustafa. He has written extensively about flood management and river management and the history of Pakistan's river management, which, as you can tell from right now, needs a bit of improvement. So we'll be speaking with him in a moment and continue to take your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We continue our conversation about the devastating floods in Pakistan. Danish Mustafa is our guest now. He's a professor of geography at King's College London and has written extensively about management, river management in Pakistan. Until a few decades ago, there were typically mild floods each summer, the time when the monsoon rainfall hits and the melt from the snowpack in the Himalaya mountains at its peak. But now, he wants to draw attention to humans having sculpted the river and the surrounding natural floodplain and wetlands for farming and for other needs. There are fewer floods, but when they hit, they are far worse, our guest says. Feel free to join our conversation. Again, the email is talk@wpr.org, and the email is, the phone is 800-486-8655. Professor Mustafa, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Catherine.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what has happened with floods? Until a few decades ago, you say they were typically mild floods. Then what happened?
Well, I think I wouldn't say a few decades ago. It's more like the river engineering in Indus has been going on for upwards of 150 years now. The British colonial administration back in the 1860s initially started the river engineering works, which are still ongoing at this stage. What happened is that rivers basically like to move around, and it's a basic principle of geomorphology that if the river does not have enough water in it, it's gonna deposit the sediment load that it is carrying. Now, every country in the world, well, most countries in the world, particularly the United States, does the same thing with the taming of the Mississippi River and many other rivers out there. But the misfortune for Pakistan is that Indus River has some of the highest sediment loads in the world. As a result, river engineering in the Indus has consequences which are much more amplified than might be the case in other river basins, comparable river basins, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So That is the physical sort of an aspect of it. Now, there were certainly floods which were, flood pulses which varied. I mean, I wouldn't say that they were all universally mild floods, if you will. You used to have high floods as well. But the society at the time was pretty much adapted to it. There were strict rules, if you will, culturally sanctioned rules about floodplain occupancy, the sorts of activities that you could undertake in the floodplain. And the society was pretty much adapted to the sort of rhythms of the river. Since the river engineering has taken place, what we have done is built a lot of levees and have almost encouraged occupancy of the floodplain with the sorts of consequences that we are observing quite dramatically at this stage.
Mm-hmm. We have also, from our previous guest, learned from him that the response once floods started in one area of Pakistan and then moved and they knew to another area that the government just was really slow, well, non-existent when it came to putting up embankments. They were just nowhere to be found. Is this a problem of the management of the government here, that they have not looked at how people's proximity to the river, and they haven't looked at management of the river?
Well, I've been hearing the same reports, and there's some truth to them. But I think overall, the government is getting a lot of flack, which perhaps is not as well deserved. Some of it is, but a lot of it is not. First thing is, I guess your question is specifically with regard to reinforcing the embankments, right? Or are you talking
Yes.
about relief as well?
No, we'll get to relief in a moment, but the embankments.
Well, the issue with embankments, that certainly is a failing, but ultimately embankments are designed to a certain design capacity. It's a social decision that a society takes and a government takes at the time of the design of the embankments, that this is the level of flooding that we're going to design these embankments for. Once the design capacity is exceeded, those embankments are going to fail, and they fail all over the world. Now, you can... And even in the United States, when you have a flooding of this magnitude, as you witnessed in 1994, I believe, in the Mississippi River, and then again in 1997, oftentimes reinforcement of the embankments is more of a local issue, something that, because local people are there, local infrastructure is there that has to respond to it. federal government or the U.S. government or your Corps of Engineers has very limited, shall we say, instant capacity to be everywhere wherever the embankment is in danger. So in that sense, maybe there should have been infrastructure in place. Maybe there should have been a good, in fact, absolutely, there should have been a much better flood warning system, which could have enabled a timely response to reinforcing the embankments. But ultimately, you cannot undo the initial design decisions that you undertook maybe years before this flood showed up, mm-hmm. about what level are you going to design those embankments for.
Mm-hmm. We have images here, Professor Mustafa, of some 20 million people who are totally displaced. The pictures on television are just horrendous of people trying to wade through water. They have no place to go. They're camping on roads. A couple questions. How much of this country has been affected by these floods? And where can they go right now? What kind of land is safe? Is this going to destroy the agriculture, the way of life of all these people who've been living along the river?
Yes, it is. And the number that I've heard most recently is about 20% of the country is underwater.
Goodness.
At the moment. And if you think about a country like Pakistan, which essentially extends from, the length of it is from Norfolk, Virginia to Key West. I mean, it's a huge country. May not look like it on a standard projection, but it's a pretty big country, and 20% of that is a vast swath of territory. So the situation is quite dire, no question about it. Where can they go? Where they are at the moment, and which is basically the roads and the train embankments and stuff, because when 20% is underwater, there's not a lot of options. But let me caution you on one thing. The flood damage, the actual physical damage from floods, yes, the crops are lost, the livestock is lost most seriously, and the housing is lost. Livestock is something that's in a rural economy like Pakistan is felt most acutely by individual households, because that's their savings accounts, in a manner of speaking. And losing that is the biggest catastrophe, followed by the houses. And then, you know, loss of crops is also a very major problem there. I think one needs to be mindful that a bigger problem that's going to arise is after the flooding, once the waters have receded. One of the problems in a plain, in an alluvial plain like the Indus, is the issue of drainage. Without the sorts of infrastructure that we have, floods would come, floods would inundate certain parts of the territory, and then they would drain away, drain right back into the channel and move on. Now what we have done is built roads, built canals, built railroad lines and that sort of thing. And now the water doesn't drain.
Mm.
And if you actually undertake, some of my colleagues have and myself as well, if you actually talk to the people, they're like, you know, the actual flood pulse is bad. You know, we know that, and, you know, we sort of, that's bad enough. But what's worse is the water doesn't go anywhere for months on end.
Mm-hmm.
Because where it was supposed to go is now a huge embankment which is carrying a road. Mm-hmm. Or a railroad track or a canal, which obstructs the natural drainage of the water. And that's when the water stays there, becomes a cesspool, mosquitoes breed, and all sorts of problems arise, as one will witness over the next few months. The only problem being that by that time it will be yesterday's news.
So you're saying that huge numbers of people should not be living there, and there shouldn't be these roads in the area, or at least as many as there are. It would call for a complete redesign?
No. I would not ask for anything that drastic. I think there are some advantages there. There are particularly strong advantages to living in the floodplain. Not the least of it is the fertility and the availability of land for agriculture. So absolutely not. I would not suggest that sort of a drastic measure. But what one would say is that when designing these infrastructures, they can be not totally redesigned, but certainly kept in mind that, in fact, flood poses these sorts of problems, and that a certain degree of engineering adaptations. I'll give you a simple example. If you go out in the floodplain in Pakistan, most floodplains in Pakistan, you'd find houses that are there in the floodplain tend to be built upon these plinth levels, which are up to 7 to 10 feet high. So the farmer is already counting upon the land being inundated to the level of 10 feet,
mm-hmm.
and their crops being underwater. And that's the sort of indigenous situation that you see all the time. I have personally seen before the flood season, going around the floodplains and stuff in certain parts of central Pakistan, people actually keep their pots and pans and quilts and, you know, a few household essentials on treetops.
Really?
There's no flood in sight, and it's probably not going to be that year. But I have seen people do that in central Pakistan because they're ready. They expect that sort of a thing to happen. Now, the question is, to what extent does the Pakistani government at various levels, and I think that's another sort of a question I'd like to get to, if you like, at
sure,
some point,
sure.
Federal and local level. To what extent does the government, the formal state infrastructure, work with the people to incorporate their adaptation strategies into its own flood response and management protocols? And that's the disconnect that I think that we need to be very attentive to. Instead of saying, oh, you know, don't live in the floodplain, which is not possible. You have to live in the floodplain. I mean, there's a benefit and cost, and at times the benefits far exceed the sorts of costs that you have to pay in terms of being flooded out periodically. So, sure. But there's an issue of, well, how do you manage the river? Do you go at the river with the assumption that actually you can control the river? Which is the assumption that the Pakistani engineers go at the river with.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go at the river and say, well, here's a problem that we have at our hands. Sometimes the river is going to have its way. Sometimes we're going to have its way. How do we make sure that our river engineering is such, for example, restoration of wetlands, that how can we modulate the flood pulse instead of trying to control it across the entire 1,200-mile length of it?
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, they're trying to modulate it across the entire 1,200-mile length of it and losing. So if you say, well, we're going to let it flow in certain parts, certain places that we have taken away from the river, and maybe we should return them to the river. And in exchange, the river would let us alone, leave us alone in certain other parts which are a lot more valuable and which we need for human sustenance. And partial use through intelligent use of crops, cropping and cropping practices, agricultural behavior, can also make use of the inundation zones that you designate as such. And in fact, there are inundation zones in the Indus, which are periodically flooded because people are living there. But that's another story I can get to.
Have people consulted you about this?
No.
Why would that be?
Well, water in Pakistan or South Asia, or I would say I shouldn't really single out Pakistan for this is true of practically all of the South, and perhaps even in the North, is deemed to be a technical engineering profession. So unless you're a civil engineer, you have no credibility to talk about these matters.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, in Pakistan, I often challenge my water... I've been consulted in the sense that I've written academic publications, which my graduate students read, much to their displeasure. But, you know... So the engineering profession is not very sympathetic to natural sciences, shall we say.
Hmm.
I ask people, well, how many process geomorphologists are there in the entire Pakistani irrigation bureaucracy or water management structure? And not one.
Oh, my.
Not one.
Huh.
Is there a pure hydrologist who works for you? Not one. Do you know how a river behaves when it is left alone? We know how it behaves when it is moves around in a concrete model that we build of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know what it does when it's not in a concrete model. And the assumption that the way we think about the river is, well, how can we make it behave the way we want it to behave, rather than understanding what its behavior might be and how might we adapt to its behavior so that we can extract benefits that we'd like to extract, while at the same note minimizing the sorts of damage that may come our way.
Mm-hmm. Let's pause for just a moment. We'll return. And welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. We're responding and trying to get a deeper understanding of the horrendous floods in Pakistan. Our guest is Professor Danish Mustafa. He is teaching in the Department of Geography at King's College in London, and he has studied the history of Pakistan's river management. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Feel free to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. 8655. If you would like to send an email, talk@WPR.org is the way to go with that, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to an email that has come in from Peter in Shawano. Would you please, Professor, discuss the dams in India and Afghanistan that control the water that is flooding into Pakistan? Is there any chance for this flooding to be caused by foreign incompetence or malice?
There aren't any substantive dams in Afghanistan. In fact, I don't know of any. There might be some run-of-the-river projects on the Kabul River, but besides that, there aren't any. In India, there is some infrastructure on the Chenab River and on the Jhelum River, as well as some of the other rivers. And there are many others that are being designed at the moment. The short answer is no. India at the moment does not have the infrastructure to have the kind of capacity to substantively affect the flood pulses in Pakistan. There is an Indus Basin Treaty between the two countries that prohibits India from building any substantive storage structures on the three western tributaries of the Indus. And that seems to be holding on reasonably well, though there are periodic conflicts between India and Pakistan regarding proposed Indian infrastructure projects on the western rivers. But that's another story that I can get into if you like. But at the moment, no, there is a fair amount of rhetoric, unfortunately. I'm a Pakistani, but I'll tell you that a lot of that rhetoric is misinformed on part of the Pakistani bureaucracy and the media that somehow India is to blame for the sorts of flooding or flooding pattern that one sees in Pakistan, not just this time, but in the past as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that.
And what about flooding in the future? Because we're trying to figure out what's causing this kind of massive flooding. It's happening in some places in the United States, not nearly to this extent, of course. You have acknowledged that rather unusual monsoon patterns from the Arabian Sea are becoming more frequent, which is frightening.
This is very strange. I mean, to be honest with you, this weather patterns that we are seeing, direct Arabian Sea monsoons, just in the past decade, we've had like three or four episodes of it. And previously, we used to have like once every few decades kind of a situation. So this is a very, very unusual situation, which is almost becoming usual now. At least in the past decade, it has become usual. Now, I would not presume to stick my neck out and say, oh, it's climate change all the way. I don't think even a climatologist would argue forcefully that, in fact, this is the smoking gun for climate change. But in fact, I certainly believe that human-induced climate change is transforming climatic patterns in very profound ways. Whether this is one of those manifestations of it, I would not dismiss that possibility,
mm-hmm.
is what I'd say.
Which
is what I can say in the interest of academic integrity, if you will.
I understand. Mm-hmm. So it would indicate that we need to take on that problem as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We should take on that problem regardless. And I think, the science of climate change is essentially telling us, without trying to pin down, well, this is what happened, or that is what will happen at that specific place at such and such time. Beyond that level of certainty, one thing can be guaranteed, that all the averages and all the sense of normality that we've had about weather patterns or climate in the past are not going to hold into the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. That's one thing I can say absolutely. So, well, greater uncertainty into the future, well, then how do we modify our behavior in order to take account of that uncertainty? I think that's the challenge.
Right. It's a large challenge.
Yeah.
In the meantime, let's look at the immediate crisis in Pakistan. What in the world are 20 million people going to do who don't have their homes, who've lost their houses, who've lost perhaps their livelihood, who aren't getting very much response from either the international community or from the government in Pakistan? What's going to happen with all these people? How can they be helped?
Well, this is a very scary prospect, because in the past, Pakistani civil society and individuals and charities and, you know, neighbors and those sorts of people have taken care of neighbors. But when you have 20% of the country underwater, immediate neighbors are in just as dire straits as you are. So it's not the kind of situation where they could step in and sort of take care of things. I think that some foreign aid is going to come in, and it's not going to be sufficient by itself. Ultimately, the Pakistani diaspora, of which there are substantive numbers in the United States as well as in the United Kingdom and the rest of the world, as well as the Pakistani state, seems to be doing, you know, I tend to disagree with the characterization that people normally give. The Pakistani state hasn't done anything. In fact, I think it is doing what it can do under the circumstances, but the scale of it is so overwhelming. I suspect that it's going to be a long-term effort. I think there's already talk in Pakistan of re-evaluating the developmental priorities, reworking the budget in order to make flood rehabilitation one of the top priorities. And that seems to be a step in the right direction. And after that, it's just, frankly, I'm overwhelmed by the challenge, as is everybody else. Like, what do you do when there's devastation? I mean, 20 million people rehabilitating them is a challenge. I can't think of last time that a government had to do that, since World War II, perhaps.
Yeah, it's enormous. And what about management to at least keep this somewhat under control, although you can't have control over huge monsoons that are coming more regularly? But is there a model somewhere else in the world, some other large river that has been managed very well that would have been able to take on this crisis? It still would have been a crisis, but not quite as bad.
I'm raking my brains at the moment, and every model I can think of is pretty rubbish, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of the Mississippi, the river that I know best outside of Pakistan, and I don't think that that's something to be followed. There's a wonderful new strategy that there's this environment agency here in the United Kingdom. Actually, it's called DEFRA, and I can't think of what that stands for, but that's the agency that deals with water resources-related issues. They came out with a new strategy for managing floodplains in the United Kingdom. The title of it was Giving Rivers Room to Flow. And that is a sea change from what the dominant paradigm of river management all across the world has been. It's an acknowledgement for the first time, as far as I know, in an actual policy document. The academia has known it for a long time. For the past three decades, I think there's pretty much a consensus within natural sciences academic community that you have to give a river room to flow. But that was the first acknowledgement that, in fact, we have to move away from controls to giving it room to flow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example I can think of, on paper at least, that would be worth studying for Pakistan and evaluating and perhaps adopting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's such a horrendous story, isn't it? You look at those pictures and you just, oh.
It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. To say nothing of all this disease that is spreading, which is bound to happen with these kinds of floods, but people can't get their antibiotics and there's no way to get to some people. It's awful.
It's going to get a lot worse. As I said, that, you know, one of the bigger problems, and this is something that the British engineers back in the 19th century recognized was going to be the consequence of them building the canals and all of these, the issue of drainage.
Mm-hmm.
Once the water shows up at a particular place, where does it drain back to? Are its natural drainage channels being blocked by the kind of infrastructure that we are building? No, inevitably you have that. You know, you do block it, but how do you make provision in your normal infrastructure, keeping that in mind, that this place could get inundated, and once the water comes in, it has to go somewhere.
Right.
And those are the sorts of ideas and thoughts and that you can easily incorporate in the existing designs of infrastructure that is there. but you just have to think about it first.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the thing with floods is that when the flood is actually happening, the wave is coming in, the people are being displaced or, you know, moving away from their places, that's when it's news. The real news story really starts once the news crews have gone away and the the flood peak is gone. That is when that cesspool is sitting there. That's when people start getting sick. That's when malaria spreads. That's when kids start dying.
Mm. Mm.
Very few people die of drowning. I mean, 1,500 is a small number. I mean, any life lost is a big deal. But you haven't seen the kinds of casualties that are going to happen. I mean, how do you attribute, what do you chalk up a death of a child 2 months from now, 3 months from now, from malnourishment or to cholera or to, you know, any other kind of diphtheria or any other sorts of diseases?
Yeah. Oh, what a story. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest, Professor Danish Mustafa, joining us from London. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for really a very informative program. And thanks for listening, everybody.